this evening, we're to have the seventh in our series of talks on the prophecy of Daniel, which will be given, as you can see, by Mr. Peter Southgate. He has asked for a reading from Daniel chapter 11, verse 36, to the conclusion of that book. So with that reading, it's now my great pleasure to ask Brother Peter to talk to us about Daniel and the prophecy.
My dear brethren and sisters, following on from the address of last week, let's just remind ourselves what we considered then. We found in chapter 10 that Daniel was mourning and fasting for 3 weeks, and that was probably because of the events that were going on in Judah, where the temple was being frustrated in its building by the opposition of the local tribes. And in response to Daniel's fasting, a magnificent angel appears, telling him that he has a message relating to Israel's latter days. And this message is the one we're to consider this evening. It occupies the whole of chapter 11 and chapter 12. We must remember that there are no chapter divisions in the original. But before we start, let's fill in the historical background, and I'm sure we're very familiar with this. There's a sequence of empires from Daniel's time onwards. Daniel was living in the time of the Persian Empire, that covered from Babylonia right down to Egypt and to the borders of India. And that was to last about another 200 or so years after Daniel's time. Then that was superseded by the Greek Empire, which overran Persia. And then in the final century before Christ, the Romans became dominant, and God's people were affected by them, as they had been with all the other empires that had ruled since Daniel's day. And we suggest that we can divide our chapter 11 into these three main aspects. Verse 2 of Daniel 11 refers to the Persian Empire. Then from verse 3 down to verse 35 refers to events that took place in the Greek Empire, and then the remaining verses, we suggest, refer to events under the rule of the Roman Empire. And then chapter 12 jumps forward to the events relating to the final time of the end at the return of Christ. So the first point we must make is that it is not a continuous prophecy. There are thousands of years which are, in fact, left out. It's detailed at first, and then, as we say, jumps forward to the time of divine intervention at the return of Christ. So the point we're making is that somewhere in this prophecy there must be a historical gap that is jumped over as far as the prophecy is concerned. Now, these are very remarkable predictions in chapter 11. Some of them are very detailed, and they contain examples of fulfilled prophecy that should strengthen the faith of every one of us. So then, we start looking at chapter 11, go to verse 2. Here we have a brief history of the Persian Empire from Daniel's day onward. As that chapter says, four Persian kings were to reign in succession, with the fourth, Xerxes, the most powerful, was to be almost the last one. And this is what actually happened. Four kings reigned and ruled over the Persian Empire. But by the time of Xerxes, the Greek threat was beginning to grow, and verse 3 describes the career of the first Greek general, Alexander the Great. Verse 3, "And a mighty king shall stand up, that shall rise with great dominion and do according to his will." So this is Alexander the Great. But I'm sure that we know from our history that Alexander's rule did not last long. He died in his 30s, and the Greek Empire was then divided amongst his four generals. We're talking now about the 300s BC. And this is what is described in verse 4. "And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken," because he had died, "and shall be divided towards the four winds of heaven." And that is actually what happened. The Greek Empire, founded by Alexander, was divided up among his four generals. And at first, as the verse says, there was a ruler in each part of the compass, north, south, east, and west. But soon, things changed. The rulers in the north and south absorbed the other two rulers, leaving the Greek Empire divided between just two rulers, the king of the north, the Seleucid kingdom, getting its name from the dominant ruler, Seleucus, and the southern kingdom, ruled in Egypt by the Ptolemies. Israel, as so often in these situations, was sandwiched in the middle. Now, the rest of chapter 11, down to verse 35, details the various activities of these two kings of the north and south. It's a wonderfully detailed prophecy that shows the divine origin of the message by the angel. There's too much detail to consider now. We have references of them fighting against each other, the king of the north and the king of the south, conducting marriage agreements and reconciliations, and then more plots and counterplots. And so what we have done, we have, in the handout which you have been given, is Brother Thomas's exposition of this period. In the handout, the light type is the actual scriptural record, and the bold type is what Brother Thomas has inserted by way of explanation so that it reads as a continuous narrative. As I say, we have no time to go into it now, but I would recommend that all of us can look at that and gain the comfort and assurance that this prophecy was absolutely wonderfully fulfilled. All we need to do is remember that the king of the north is based in Syria and the king of the south is based in Egypt. Now, I'd like to jump straight away now to the end of this section of Daniel chapter 11. Going forward to a time in history of about BC 166, and we have in verse 34 an event described which actually refers to the uprising of the Maccabees. Now, the Maccabees were a successful Jewish group in their revolt against the king of the north. Antiochus had come down, spoiled the temple, insisted on desecrating it, so much so that the Jews responded by revolting, and that revolt was in fact successful. So the king of the north was temporarily, at least, excluded from Jerusalem, and the Judeans, the Maccabees, set up their own kingdom. As we say, the revolt was caused by this attack on Jewish religion and practices. They forced the Jews to eat pork and even offered a pig on the temple altar at Jerusalem. And this autonomy of the Jews continued until the rising power of Rome annexed Judea in about 70 BC. Now, so far, so good. I think it's true to say that every expositor is agreed on this interpretation, that it describes the various interactions between the Greek and the Egyptian sections of the Greek Empire, the northern, the Syrian, and the Egyptian sections of the Greek Empire until the rising power of Rome. But when we come to verse 35 onwards, we have some problems. Let's go back first of all to verse 34. I should have mentioned verse 30 about have indignation against the Holy Covenant. This is the King of the North defiling the temple. Verse 31, take away the daily sacrifice, plant the abomination that makes desolate. Now, verse 34, when they shall fall, they shall be holpen or helped with a little help. And that refers, we say, to the successful revolt of the Maccabees by which they were helped against the King of the North and became independent. But then, immediately after, verse 36 onwards, we have the rise of a proud, blasphemous ruler, styled in verse 36 to 39, the King, who, at the time of the end, verse 40, will be prodded by the King of the South, upon which the King of the North will respond by a massive invasion down through what is described as the glorious land and will enter Egypt, robbing and pillaging. But, verse 45, this will come to the end and none shall help him. Well, who is this king who arises after the time of the Maccabees? We must remember the focus of this vision which was given to Daniel by the angel. We read in verse 14 of chapter 10, we considered it last week, that the angel was sent to tell Daniel what shall happen to his people, that is the Jews, in the latter days. Now that term latter days can have many particular fulfillments. There are other such terms as the time of the end, the end of the days, the last days, the latter days. Not all of these refer to what we often today refer to as the time of the end, in other words, the time when Christ is coming back to the earth. We must always determine which time of the end and what end is being spoken about. And we need to look at the context in order to decide that. As I say, it's not always the last days. It could, for example, be the end of the Jewish national existence. After all, that was what Dan was being told by the angel. Or it could indeed, excuse me, refer to the final end. So we need to address two crucial questions relating to these verses 36 to 45. Is this section continuing the history of the Jews from a time soon after the Maccabean independence revolt, which seemed the logical thing to do because all their previous things in the chapter had followed on fairly soon after each other? Or do we have a completely different scenario from verse 36 onward. And then we need to decide which time of the end is being referred to in verse 40. Now, our conventional view, one that I and I'm sure most of us were brought up to believe, is that the time of the end is at Christ's return, and that the events described from verse 36 onwards are a summary of what happened in the period from the Maccabees right down to our own days. By this interpretation, the king of verse 6, the king shall do according to his will, is the Roman power that took over Judah, and then that developed into the Roman Catholic apostasy with all its blasphemous ways, and so fulfilled the descriptions in those ensuing verses. And then at the time of the end, that is the return of Christ, the papacy would unite with the northern invader described in Ezekiel 38, the Gogian invader. And then somehow this confederacy of the king of the north of the future and Christ will be prodded by the king of the south, and the king of the south was originally thought of as Britain. That's a view now very much more soft-pedaled. And this confederation would descend on Israel, establish itself there, only to be destroyed by Christ at the time of trouble mentioned in chapter 12, verse 1. I've just realised that I said earlier on that the king of the north allied with Christ. I didn't mean that. What I meant was he allied with the papacy. Well, that's, as I say, is the standard interpretation that I certainly was taught, and I think most of us have been brought up with. But for me, there are one or two problems with this. It assumes that the time of the end is at the return of Christ. As I've already hinted, it could refer to the end of the Jews as a nation. Another problem is, where is a king of the south today who is going to prod the king of the north, allegedly Russia? Thirdly, are there a lot of precious things, gold and silver and precious things in modern Egypt that would incite the cupidity of a northern invader? We suggest that the answer to this dilemma is in the first verse of chapter 12. Let's read it. "And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book." This time of trouble, that I think is the key to the interpretation of these verses. Daniel quite clearly says that this time of trouble, there's never been anything like it before until his day. Such as never was. It's an exclusive time of trouble. I know that conventionally we refer this to the terrible judgments at the return of Christ. That is, the time of trouble is yet future. But look at Matthew chapter 24, where we find there's another time of reference to a time of trouble, this time by none other than Jesus himself in the Mount Olivet prophecy. We know that this prophecy was given in response to Jesus saying that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed, and we know that that took place by the Romans. But look at what Christ says about Jerusalem's destruction, which we know took place in AD 70. Matthew chapter 24, verse 14. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached into all nations for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. So here's an end coming. Daniel was speaking of the time of the end. And then he goes on to say, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand, then let them which be in Judea flee to the mountains. So here is a clear reference to the Roman invasion and destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And Jesus is saying that this is a fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy. But now look at what he then goes on to say in verse 21. Remember Daniel spoke of a time of trouble. Here we have great tribulation, obviously the same thing. For there shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, almost exactly quotating from Daniel chapter 12, verse 1. But then he adds this crucial comment, no, nor ever shall be. So this time of trouble, such as never was, that Daniel spoke about, the great tribulation of AD 70, was absolutely a one-off event. It was never to be repeated. No, nor ever shall be. So Jesus, quoting Daniel 12, is saying that the terrors of AD 70, terrible as they were never to be repeated. But we know that that event is now in the past. So Daniel's reference, therefore, must be to the time of trouble of AD 70, not anything that we can expect to happen in our days, because Jesus said that time of trouble would never be repeated, and it has already taken place. Once we accept, going back to Daniel, that the time of the end of verse 40 refers to AD 70 and the end of the Jewish national existence, culminating in the time of trouble such as never was when the Romans sacked Jerusalem, then we need to look again at the closing verses of chapter 11. So going back to verse 36, we suggest that a king would follow on directly from the quite clear reference to the Maccabees in verse 34. So we ask, as far as the Jewish nation was concerned, what notable events occurred soon after the times of the Maccabees? The king of the north, Syria, Rome, in those days, and the king of the south still existed as political powers because the Roman power had taken over Syria to become the king of the north and had occupied Judah. Then, verse 36, the king appears on the scene, a bombastic, blasphemous autocrat who magnifies himself above all, we're told. Well, we suggest that the king here must be Herod the Great. It fits the description, verse 37 to 39. If you glance through those verses, we've got a description of a tyrannical ruler, one who made fortresses, one who was renowned for his building exploits. We know he built castles, fortresses, great civil works, many palaces, especially the temple. He certainly magnified himself above all. So it seems appropriate that Herod is referred to here as coming on after the times of the Maccabees. And with this identification, we will see that the events predicted in the rest of this chapter 11 fit exactly into the history of those times. We've got the Roman king of the north, we've got the Egyptian king of the south, and then verse 40, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. This is going to happen at the time of the end of the Jewish national existence. What actually happened? Well, the historical facts of those times fit the angel's description perfectly. Because at that time, the king of the south, Egypt, was ruled by Cleopatra. The Roman Empire was ruled by what was known as the Triumvirate, three Caesars ruling together, Octavian, Mark Antony, and Lepidus. And then Mark Antony and Octavian fell out and quarreled, and Mark Antony went over to Cleopatra in the south. So Mark Antony and Cleopatra now became the king of the south. And history tells us that Egypt, the king of the south under Mark Antony, made a bid for supreme power. He marshaled an army and a navy against Octavian in the north, who responded by building a fleet of 400 ships to confront him, the many ships of verse 40. And the two navies met at the famous Battle of Actium in 31 BC, in which Antony and Cleopatra were roundly defeated. But Octavian, the king of the north, wasn't content with that. He decided to follow up this victory with a land assault on Egypt. He marched down, obviously, through Palestine, like a whirlwind, through the glorious land, captured and despoiled Egypt with its treasures of gold and silver and precious things, because it was still a very wealthy nation in those days, and then across North Africa to Libya. The Ethiopians and the Libyans were at his steps, we read. Coming down through the land of Judea, his objective being to attack the king of the south in Egypt, he had no reason to cross over into Transjordan, and therefore Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon, verse 41, didn't need to be invaded. They escaped this southern invasion by Octavian. We suggest that the correspondence between the prophecy and history is quite striking. The angel was certainly giving Daniel an insight into the events leading up to Judah's time of the end in AD 70. And it seems that verses 44 to 47 revert to the activities of Herod the Great. He certainly planted a palace in Jerusalem between the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea, verse 45. The Gospels record how at the birth of Jesus he was troubled by news from the east that was carried by the wise men who would have approached Jerusalem from the north, tidings out of the east and north, troubled him. And we read there in the Gospels of the great fury with which he went out and destroyed and annihilated many in the massacre of the innocents. Well, what happened next? The angel then says, beginning of chapter 12, that at this time, remember the no chapter divisions, Michael shall stand up, the great prince that stands watch over the sons of your, Daniel's, people. Who is Michael? Before we jump to any conclusions and say that this must refer to Christ, let's look at other references. In Jude verse 9, we read of Michael the archangel. In Daniel chapter 10, verse 13, the angel that came to Daniel is styled Michael, one of the chief princes. So it seems that Michael was a special angel, as distinct from Jesus, who is styled in chapter 8, verse 25 of Daniel, the prince of princes. So the angels were princes, but there was a prince of princes. The name Michael means one who is like God, one who is God's representative. And there are many examples in the Old Testament of angels representing God, notably in Exodus chapter 23, verse 20, where God may indeed have been speaking of this Michael who stands watch over the children of your people, because he said, "Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way. Beware of him and obey his voice. Do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him." So here was a Michael, one who bore the name of God. We suggest then that in chapter 12, verse 1, it is the archangel Michael that stands up in this punitive capacity. God said in Exodus, he will keep them and protect them, or he will punish them. Judah certainly deserved punishment now, and he stands up. This original word for stand sometimes implies opposition and punishment. In Isaiah chapter 3, we read, "The Lord stands up to judge his people." So we suggest that at the Jewish nation's time of the end, that is AD 70, Israel's angel will stand up to punish the nation, just as Jesus had predicted in the Mount Olivet prophecy. And going on through to the rest of verse 1 of chapter 12, we see that the next comment of the angel also links with Christ's words. At this never-to-be-repeated time of trouble, we read, "At that time, "And at that time, thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book." Yes, we read, didn't we, in Matthew, that Jesus told his disciples to flee from the troubles of AD 70. "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." And they did. And they escaped safely to Pella and lived there in safety. So far, we've seen that these latter verses of Daniel can apply to the events of the last days of the Jews as a nation. But obviously, we must agree that as this prophecy extends right to the setting up of the kingdom, when Daniel will stand in his lot at the end of the days, then there must be somewhere a gap. And we suggest that it is between verses 1 and 2 of chapter 12. As Christ does in the Mount Olivet prophecy, remember, he jumps forward without any break or comment from the destruction of Jerusalem to his second coming. So does Daniel's angel in these verses. Having described the time of trouble in verse 1, this is the gap of 2,000 or so years, verse 2, "And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt." So he goes forward right to the return of Christ, the time of resurrection and reward, the righteous shining as the stars forever and ever. Well, we put these forward as suggestions, but we may like to think of them as bringing all the scriptural and the historical data together, which I think other expositions sometimes fail to do. Daniel, by this time, was obviously very concerned. So he asks, how long is it going to all last? When shall the vision end? Verse 6. I looked. How long shall it be to the end of these wonders? Verse 6. The angel told him, verse 9. He said, go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. And from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,335 days. But go thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days. There have been many, many interpretations of this, all of which assume that the 1290 and the 1335 days or years commence at the same time. But obviously, because of the varying length, have different finishing points. But when was the daily sacrifice taken away? There were many times, wasn't there? It was done by the Babylonians when they sacked Jerusalem in Daniel's day. It was done, as we read, by Antiochus when he defiled the temple in the time of the Maccabees. It was done by the Romans when they destroyed Jerusalem. Is the abomination of desolation Roman, as many once thought it was? Or was it Muslim, as later expositors, such as Brother Frank Janaway, for example, in the 1930s, thought? Well, all the previously suggested expiry dates, whatever way we look at it, have now long passed, and still, as we obviously realise, the end has not come. Well, personally, we'd like to suggest another approach. Rather than let the two dates, 1290 and 3035, run in parallel, why don't we add the two together? And if you now look at the back of the handout, you will see that I have set out there a possible solution. You see, previously it was thought that the taking away of the daily sacrifice and the setting up of the abomination described the same event. But the original Hebrew actually suggests there are two separate events, one at the start and the other at the end of the 1290 years. So you're going to take away the sacrifice at the beginning of the 1290 and set up the abomination at the end of the 1290. So when was the daily sacrifice taken away? Well, it seems appropriate, as the message was given to Daniel, it would be Daniel's own times that would be referred to. The time that Daniel remembered so clearly when the Babylonians took Jerusalem. That was what he would immediately think of, wouldn't he? Well, there were three attacks by the Babylonians on Jerusalem, and thus three possible starting dates for the 1290 years. We indicate on the chart, the first invasion of destruction or attack on Jerusalem was BC 606, when that's when Daniel was taken captive. 598, the next one, and 586, the final one, when Zedekiah was dethroned and killed. Now, adding 1290 to these, we come right forward to the times of the Muslim domination, certainly a setting up of an abomination in Jerusalem. If we add 1290 to the BC 606, that gives us AD 684, and that was the very year that the Dome of the Rock, that Muslim shrine on the Temple Mount, was commenced. If we take the second one, 598 BC, and add 1290, we get to the year that the dome was finished. If we add 1290 to586, which is the final destruction of Jerusalem, when certainly the temple sacrifice was taken away, we come to the building of the El-Aqsa Mosque. That's the mosque at the southern end of the temple platform that even today is still a major shrine of the Muslims. So certainly there was an abomination set up or completed on each termination date, whichever one we take. Now, the thrilling part. Add the 1335 to these dates, brings us right up to our own times, ending, as you see on the chart, 2019, 2027, and 2039, respectively. We obviously can't be prophets, and we're not attempting to be that. But obviously these things were given to us for those who are wise at the end of the times to understand, as Daniel was told. So there must be an interpretation that is valid. Otherwise, God wouldn't have given it to us. But if this interpretation is correct, we're at the very end of the days that Daniel is referred to in these closing verses. Because we believe, don't we, that there will be a whole series of events between the actual return of Christ and the final establishment of the kingdom of God. We've got the Gogian invasion of Ezekiel 38. We've got the preaching of the everlasting gospel. That will take some time. We've got the gathering to Armageddon and the destruction of the beast nations. And maybe these various dates reflect these or some other stages in the work that Christ will do. If this is so, then we might like to think, and certainly hope, that the return of Christ is very much nearer than we think. But we just have to wait and see, won't we? There's one thing we can be sure about. When this final time of the end will have come, Daniel will have been resurrected, will have been rewarded for his faithfulness. He will stand in his lot, in his inheritance at the end of the days. And along with him will be the many who, Daniel says, will be purified, made white and refined when mortality will be swallowed up of life. Well, may we all be found ready for that day and in God's mercy be among those who are the wise who shall shine as the stars forever and ever.